Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, we talk about the three E's all the time here. That's our focus: the economy, energy, and the environment. And as you well know, my view is that knowing about where we are in the energy story is more important than tracking the economy closely. The economy is a subset of energy, not the other way around. No energy, no economy. It's really that simple. Now, digging a little deeper, we know that it's the energy returned on the energy you invest that provides the surplus energy upon which every single facet of our sophisticated, technological, mobile, and abundant lifestyles depend. Now, recently, there have been a number of energy narratives dominating the U.S. and global airwaves that really should not go unchallenged. I'm very excited to have today's guest on because I know of nobody that's been doing a better job of unpacking the complexities and tracking the realities of the oil portion of our energy story. Coming to us from Sugar Land, Texas, what better location, right, is Arthur Berman, a geological consultant with 34 years of experience in petroleum exploration and production. He's published over 100 articles on petroleum geology and technology, made 25 presentations just in the last year to professional societies, investment conferences, and companies, and is currently consulting for several E&P companies and capital groups in the energy sector. You might have seen him on CNBC, CNN, or in Platts Energy Week, BNN, Bloomberg, in the Financial Times, New York Times. He's been there. Arthur, thank you so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure to be with you, Chris.
So let's start with the shale oil narrative. It goes something like this. U.S. ingenuity and technological breakthroughs have unlocked vast amounts of oil, so much that the world supplies are now swamped, and in reaction, the price has plunged by more than 50%. Saudi Arabia is fighting to preserve market share by refusing to cut production so that they may gain a longer-term advantage over U.S. producers. Anything wrong with that narrative?
Well, there's everything wrong with that narrative. Of course, everything in that narrative has some basis in truth, or it wouldn't be the storyline that it is. But let's start with the vast resources of new oil that have been unlocked by shale or tight oil production. You know, if you look at any kind of reasonable assessment of the plays, and there's really only two of them. It's the Bakken Shale in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford Shale in South Texas. The Permian certainly is producing a lot of oil, but it's kind of another story that we could talk about a bit later. And the reason it's another story is because the reserves just aren't really there. But if we look at the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, and we look at the proven reserves that anyone can find on the EIA, Energy Information Administration's website, and we look at both the proven and the proven undeveloped, which basically are, you know, still not drilled yet, what we find is a big surprise, and that is that, you know, we've only got something like 2 years worth of production left given current U.S. consumption. And, you know, to listen to the kinds of things that we hear on television and on the radio and read in the newspapers, you know, you'd think we've got decades and decades of production. But the numbers just aren't that big, Chris. I mean, we're talking about 10 billion barrels of oil from all of the tight oil plays. And again, that's not my interpretation. That's what's on, you know, those are the published proven plus proven undeveloped reserves based on the latest information we have. Well, the United States uses about 5.5 billion barrels of oil every year. So 10 billion barrels from tight oil is less than 2 years. And you know, those are the facts. You know, we can talk about any other narratives or storylines you want, but as far as I'm concerned, you know, that's the bottom line. And like I say, I'm including the proven undeveloped reserves, which are, you know, which have not been drilled. And ordinarily, my advice to companies is, you know, don't put too much faith in proven undeveloped reserves because a lot of them won't be there.
And why won't they be there?
Because they're not commercial. The way that the Securities and Exchange Commission generously rewrote the rules for booking reserves for the shale players, this was back in 2010, was that you can book anything as a proven undeveloped reserve simply by proximity. So in other words, if you've got a tract that's, you know, within a mile or two of a producing well, you can call that proven undeveloped. Now, as we know from all oil and gas drilling, but particularly from shale oil and gas drilling, you know, one location away, which is to say, you know, maybe 40 to 90 acres away, is always a big surprise. But a mile away, you know, 640 acres away, you don't have any idea what's out there, because the rock is far from homogeneous. And even when we look at the core, the best areas, the sweet spots, if you will, of these shale plays, there's tremendous variability between closely spaced wells. So that's why I say that, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot for those proven undeveloped reserves. We'll know when they're drilled, and right now it's just a placeholder, a very generous placeholder, I might add.
You know, I think it was 2011, or maybe 12. I'm losing track of time, I guess. But I remember reading a presentation by Continental Resources, and they were talking about how in the Bakken they were going to do this downhole spacing. They were going to go down deeper into the Three Forks formations, and they were going to claim they were going to have up to, I don't know, 20 wells per pad per section. Do you know what came of that?
Well, I haven't seen any results that suggest that that's a reality. And here's the problem, Chris. I mean, I've seen similar kinds of, you know, of fairy tales that have been presented for the Permian Basin by Continental Resources, Pioneer Natural Resources. And, you know, so first, could you do that? Yeah, absolutely, you could. I mean, the technology exists to do it. Big question: what does it cost? You know, the way these guys draw on their whiteboards and put all these laterals stacked at different depths makes it look like a piece of cake, literally a piece of layer cake is what they call it. But each one of those wells still costs, you know, in the case of the Bakken, $10 million. So, you know, so you can do it. Yeah, you can do it. The question is, does it make any money? Does it even break even? And that's the part that, you know, is almost never addressed in the narrative that we're talking about. Is anybody even breaking even in these plays, much less making money? And what if they do what they're telling everybody they're going to do, which is to drill these, you know, these tiered multilateral wells, or they talk about, you know, infilling on, you know, 40-acre spacing or something like that? And, you know, again, the question is, well, yeah, you can do that, but, you know, what does that do to your returns? What does that do to your profits? And they never want to talk about that.
Well, I'd love to talk about this profit side a bit, and because I've been very confused by what's going on there. So before we get to the actual company profitability, maybe you can shed some light on this. You know, with the rundown in oil prices, the media was just swamped with various analyses coming from a variety of usually sell-side analysts saying, here's the all-in break-even cost for play X, play Y, play Z. So, you know, they, you know, stack all the plays out. I never really understood what was involved in those break-even analyses. Can you shed some light on that? Are these companies, when we're looking at those, are we looking at truly the all-in, full-cycle, self-sustaining break-even cost? Is this just the per-well drilling cost? What are we looking at when we're looking at a chart that purports to tell us what the break-even cost of a play is?
Well, that's the key question, Chris. It's like you know, it's like asking what does it cost. I mean, it's easy to say this is what it is, but what's involved? You know, what are your assumptions? And so, your point is dead on, and that is what costs have been included and what costs have been excluded. Now, you know, I've read all those silly articles, and basically, this is a pattern that we see. We saw it with shale gas when the price of gas dropped from, you know, $14 or $15 per 1,000 cubic feet, first to 8, and then to 6, and then to 4. And every time the price goes down, the companies have another fairy tale for why they're still going to make money or break even on the lower price. Well, we've seen the same thing as oil prices have dropped. When oil prices dropped to 80, we saw you know, a whole stream of articles saying, oh, well, you know, all these companies can still make money at 80, and then it went to 70, and now they can make money at 70. And, you know, recently I've seen some preposterous articles that say that, you know, some of these operators can, you know, make money at $20 or $30 a barrel. It's bogus. The whole thing is bogus. So what they're doing for the most part is they're just telling you about point forward costs. They're just telling you if their only costs were drilling and completion, then what price could they break even at? And, you know, that's fine. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a measurement that is useful in some ways, because companies have different amounts of debt and different amounts of overhead and differing levels of operating costs and all of that. But if you're really talking about a break even price, at the very least, I mean, you have to include what are your lease operating expenses? What does it cost to do business out there, you know? You got people that run around checking, you know, metering wells, and you've got royalties and taxes and transportation and gathering. Plus, you got a whole company with employees and buildings. And I mean, yeah, that stuff is not free. And these oil and gas companies don't have another profit center to charge it to, so eventually it all comes back to the well. And then there's debt. Almost none of these companies have low debt. Most of the independents, their debt is something like 50% or more of their value. And they've got to pay interest on that debt every month, just like you and I do on whatever loans we have. Now, you factor all that in, and what you find is the best companies, and there are some good ones, in the very best parts of the plays are maybe breaking even at $95 or $90 a barrel. Now, we did a study recently for a client where we looked at the core of the Bakken, the four counties that are the sweetest of the sweet spots, and we looked at the top operators, and we did the full analysis. And what we came up with was that in that very best part of the Bakken, you needed about $83 per barrel of oil equivalent to break even. Now, the other thing that's bogus about these analyses is, where do you get your reserve numbers from? I mean, everybody who's listening to this knows something about economics, and you got to have a number. I mean, what's your average well? You're saying your average well breaks even at, you know, price X. Well, tell me what reserve number that's based on, because if you're basing that break-even price on a reserve that says you're going to make, you know, 1 million barrels of oil versus 750,000, well, the economics are going to be completely different, and therefore the break-even price is going to be different. And it's not just the reserves, it's the rates at which you produce that well. Are you going to produce that, let's say, 1 million barrels over 50 years, or are you going to produce it over 5 years? Because we're talking about the time value of money, and the faster you get your money back, the quicker you drill out of you get out of your net present value hole in the ground. So, you know, none of these things are ever discussed. And frankly, most of the you know, so-called research analysis that's done, I think they just get their reserves from the companies. The companies just make up a story and tell them, okay, our average well makes this much, and that's what they use. Now, you know, I go in and actually figure out what I think the most likely reserves are by doing the hard work, by doing the decline curve analysis and doing that. And once you've got the reserves, and once you've got all the costs, and costs are publicly available, I mean, these companies give it to the Securities and Exchange Commission, then you can actually do the real work of figuring out where do they break even, and it's way above what you're hearing in mainstream media.
Well, maybe this helps explain a conundrum, confusion that I've had for a while. For years, I've been tracking the financial returns of the largest shale operators. It's about 80 in my list that I look at, and specifically the cash flow statements, because to me that's, you know, these are supposed to be cash cows, and it always comes back to the cash flow. If you want to know if a business is going to do well or not, are they producing positive free cash flows? And what I've seen there, and other people have commented on this as well, it's pretty well known, I think. I've even seen it printed in Bloomberg, but these companies have consistent negative free cash flows. Every year I've been tracking them, including 2011, 12, 13, when oil prices were twice what they are. I'd love to get your take on this phenomenon. I mean, does it make sense that I should be concerned that a company that theoretically is doing a plumbing operation in the Bakken and is making money and breaking even at theoretically at $50 a barrel, that they were all sporting steeply negative free cash flows through what were arguably the best years?
You've got to look at that, Chris. I mean, that's absolutely critical. And I look at it too. I mean, if you look at third quarter earnings, we'll get full year earnings here. Well, they're starting to come in now. February is usually the month. But I see the same thing you do. And that is that the very best of the companies in these tight oil plays, companies like EOG, for instance, they're barely cash flow positive. And of course, when you're looking at the free cash flow number, you're not really sure of all the costs that have been included. You got to look at each statement. But yes, you're absolutely right. If we look at the oil weighted onshore companies, and I follow about 50 of them, what you find is that their third quarter results say that they got negative free cash flow of about $5 billion. Well, the price of oil in third quarter was $93 a barrel. So you can just imagine what fourth quarter is going to look like. I mean, it's going to be a total train wreck if they were losing money back then. So yeah, I look at the same thing you do. I look at free cash flow, the difference between capital expenditure and cash from operations. I look at debt pretty hard too. And debt to equity is an okay measure, except that you got to take the company's word for their equity. I like to look at debt as a function of free cash flow. In other words, how long would it take this company based on the free cash flow that it's showing to pay off its debt? Well, if they got negative free cash flow, they're never going to pay off their debt. They keep getting farther and farther into debt every year. So, my view on this thing is that a lot of people don't fully understand the technical work that I do, and I don't expect them to. And maybe they say, well, we've read other people's analyses that are more optimistic than yours. And I say, fine, let's put that on the table on the side for a second. Let's look at what you look at, Chris. Let's look at the cash flows and the balance sheets of these companies, because if they're really as profitable as they say, then we ought to see it reflected in the cash flows and the balance sheets. And we don't. We just don't. And I wish I could say something different, but these are facts, and we have to look at facts.
Another fact that's eluded me for a while is looking at, for instance, the severance taxes that Texas pulls out, or the rate of taxation that North Dakota is pulling out, or Pennsylvania. So oil gets pulled out of the ground. A portion of that, goes to the royalty owner. A portion of that goes to the state. And I look at those state pulls, and in Texas, they actually did a study where they said, wow, we pulled in about $1 billion in severance taxes. Hey, over the same period, we incurred about $4 billion in road damage, infrastructure damage, roads, bridges, and things like that. It seems to me that the all-in cost of a barrel of oil, if we want to include that socialized part, which is, let's be clear, I think that the taxpayers of Texas are subsidizing the business. If you're only pulling $1 billion and you're incurring $4 billion of costs, is that a fair way to look at it? And is it true then that the all-in cost of this barrel is still being subsidized in some way that we haven't really accounted for yet?
Sure. And I know that you think about the same things I do. I think about net energy, or energy return on investment. And you're talking about highways and other sorts of infrastructure. And typically that's not included. But let's just look at the physical energy that you have to put in to get a barrel of oil out. And most of this tight oil has a return of something like 5 to 1. So you get back 5 units of energy for every one that you put in, and we compare that to just about any other source of energy. If we look at like Middle Eastern oil, it's probably something like 100 to 1, and most conventional world averages outside the Middle East are maybe 30 to 1. So the fact when we hear that the United States is going to be energy self-sufficient, or we're moving in that direction, we have to be very clear that this is super expensive oil that's being produced. And who bears the cost of that? There are the social costs and the infrastructure costs. But basically what we're seeing unfolding right now, as oil prices are down below $50, is the ground truth. The ground truth is that these plays cannot survive on anything other than sustained $100, $90, $9,500 oil prices. And that's the bottom line. So while everybody's celebrating and beating our chests about how, you know, we're the best and we're number one, let's keep in mind, you know, as long as the world can afford to pay for $100 oil, you know, maybe we are number one, but watch what happens when that price goes down a little bit, as it has right now, and you'll see that, no, we're not number one. And along those lines, if you just look at proven reserves of the world, and, you know, again, anybody can access this information, the United States is a very long 11th among the the producers of the world, you know, which isn't bad. I mean, it's not bad to be 11th. You know, it's good to finish a marathon as opposed to not being able to finish it at all, but you're not in the top tier, okay? And so when we actually look at reserves versus just rates of production, I mean, that's, you know, the rate of production is the sprint, the reserve is the marathon. The United States is not a big oil producer. And as I said, we're going to be out of this stuff in a couple of years. And just today, I was looking at the Eagle Ford Shale, which is one of the two biggest plays, and according to many analysts in the United States, that is, many analysts, you know, it's the play that has the most durable break-even oil price at low cost. Well, you know, even the EIA shows Eagle Ford oil production peaking in 2016. That's next year. Where do we get this decades of production? Well, okay, fair enough. The production from the Eagle Ford isn't going to stop in 2016. It'll go on for many, many years, but at, you know, greatly reduced rates of production every year. So in this particular case, you know, I think the EIA and the IEA have it, you know, pretty close to right. Not exactly right, but pretty close. They look at the U.S. tight oil plays and they see a couple of years, you know, maybe 5 years before things start to fall off. You know, I think it's less, but, you know, I'm not going to split hairs. The point is that what we found is expensive and we've got a few years, not decades of it. So when we start hearing people pounding the table about how the United States should, you know, should lift the ban on crude oil exports, well, you know, that's another topic if we're just talking about free trade and regulation. But what in the world is a country like ours doing, still importing, you know, 5+ million barrels of crude oil a day, and we've got maybe 2 years of supply from tight oil? What are we thinking about that we're going to export oil? I mean, what's that about? I mean, it's just a dumb idea. You know, it's like borrowing money from a bankrupt person. You know, it's like, wow, what are you guys thinking about here? And I'll tell you what they're thinking about. I mean, the companies are thinking that they can, it's easier for them just to sell the oil overseas than it is to go through all the hassle of having to blend it with heavier oil and refine it and then go sell that overseas. But so, you know, any way you look at this thing, Chris, I mean, I think you just have to be realistic. And the realistic view is, let's give ourselves credit for ingenuity. You know, we've done something that a few years ago probably almost no one thought was possible. But let's also be realistic. I mean, this is the most mature petroleum province on earth. We're squeezing blood from a stone, and as long as prices are high, we'll squeeze a little more. And that's it. I mean, I like to talk about these shale plays as not a revolution, but a retirement party. I mean, you know, this is the kind of bittersweet celebration you have when you're almost out the door and, you know, going to sit around the house and watch, you know, Duck Dynasty or whatever for your remaining days. It's not really cause for a celebration. It's cause for, you know, for some sobering concerns and taking stock about, you know, what's the future have in store for us as a country, as a world.
You know, there's a lot of interesting points in there. That the one I want to speak to right now is here's what I hear some people say. They say, look, Chris, nobody really predicted how much and how fast we were going to get oil out of the Bakken or the Eagle Ford plays, and so probably we can't predict where we're going to find the next source of oil, as if there were something out there more. How this is where I get driven a little bit nuts, because here's what I love to do. I went once to Midland and made it to the oil museum there, which is like the Louvre of oil museums. It's fantastic, right? And mm-hmm. and it's just very clear that geologists have done a great job of mapping all the basins in the world where oil could possibly have formed, right? Sedimentary basins, they had to have the right conditions. And then, you know, geologically, things had to work out. The shale plays really represent source rocks that have been mapped, drilled through, tantalizingly poked at for a long time. We always knew there was oil there. In your mind, is there a next big set of finds that could really surprise us that might change the story?
There's always a certain unknown out there, you know, that, the United States oil production peaked in 1970 and, you know, then Prudhoe Bay was discovered, you know, a few years later, and we had another kind of resurgence of oil for a couple of years, not ever reaching the peak levels we did before. And people say, oh, well, see, there's always something out there. And for sure, I mean, Prudhoe is the biggest oil field ever found in the United States. But again, it's way up in the Arctic. It's super expensive oil. And so, you know, it's really exactly what the models of peak oil would predict, that once your conventional production peaks, then you're going to be increasingly driven to more expensive, lower quality kinds of sources. And that's exactly what, you know, what we're seeing. So, you know, the answer then is, sure, you know, we'll find something more than what we have. Will we find the equal of what we've found so far? Highly unlikely. Like you say, I mean, you know, these shale basins are not news. I mean, we've known about them. The industry's known about them for decades, and we've had, you know, the big companies have teams of geologists and geophysicists and engineers studying them for decades and asking themselves the question, gee, you know, could these things ever be commercial? You know, at some oil price and with some new technology, could they be commercial? And so when the prices got high enough and the technology arrived, as it did with horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, companies knew exactly where to go. It wasn't a big mystery. So will there be more outside the United States? Sure there will. I there's the Bashanov shale in Russia. There's the Vaca Muerta in Argentina. There's the Duvernay in Canada. And there's probably a handful of others. But are there infinite opportunities? No. Look at all the source rocks that we have in the United States and all of our basins, and how many of them actually work, too. It's the same with shale gas. I mean, we've got gas that's been produced in every basin in the country, has a gas source rock. How many of those plays have been anywhere close to commercial? 5. So the subset of what's potentially commercial versus everything that's out there is a tiny, tiny number. So could there be another tight oil play in the United States? Probably. It's probably one. Will it be as good as the Bakken or the Eagle Ford? I can't say because I don't know what it is. Let's just say it could be. Okay. You know, what's the next one look like? Well, we already know where they are and they're small. If they were any good, they'd be being developed today. So that's the problem.
Now, you had another very excellent point in there that I wanted to just parse out for people, and this is because this is part of the narrative. It gets put out there all the time, this idea of energy independence. This is where I think it came through, Arthur. Maybe it was 2010, 11, somewhere in that zone again. The EIA switched from reporting on our individual subsets of energy, like how energy independent are we with respect to coal, oil, gas, stuff like that. They put it all into one spot, measured all the BTUs at once as if they were all equivalent BTUs, and said, oh, we're going to achieve energy independence. But the thing I'd love for you to talk to is this idea of, I mean, you mentioned we're still importing 5.5 million barrels per day. What are the odds that the United States will find a way to produce an additional 5.5 million barrels per day to completely 100% remove us from oil imports and then sustain that level of production?
zero, to be just as blunt as possible. You know, if you're talking about crude oil, and that's what I'm talking about, I'm not talking about all the add-ons that also get included in those estimates, you know, the natural gas liquids and the biofuels and the refinery gain and all that kind of silliness. But, you know, realistically, we might see another million or two barrels in addition to the about nine that we're producing right now. That's optimistic, but you know, I think it's realistic. And I think that, you know, EIA is still sticking to its story that that U.S. production is going to peak at something like 10 million barrels a day, which is not all that much farther. It's another million above what we are right now. So the only way that the United States will become energy independent was in many ways. But one is that we find another 6 million barrels a day on top of the 10 million, because that's how much we use. And I frankly just don't see that as being a very likely outcome. Or we just use a heck of a lot less, you know, that we just decide, well, you know, the price of oil is too expensive, and we decide to, you know, fundamentally modify the way that we consume the stuff. And, you know, transport is the big ticket item here. I mean, something like 70 or 75% of all the oil used in the United States is used for driving cars, flying airplanes, you know, other uses of basically gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. So we could become energy self-sufficient if everybody stopped driving around in their personal cars. You know, I don't see that as being something that sells very well, but you know, that, so there are ways of being energy independent, but not, I don't think, by producing our way to energy independence and continuing to, you know, to live the kind of extravagant lifestyles that we do. So you talk then about, well, we got a lot of natural gas, you know, we got coal, we got all sorts of other things that we could use. And yeah, that's all true. And the technology does exist, for instance, to use natural gas to, you know, to power automobiles and buses and things like that. But there are big issues that never really get talked about, like how long might it take to do that if we decided that we wanted to do that aggressively? And what kinds of infrastructure would be required in order to accomplish that? You know, we talk a lot about renewables, and I'm 100% in favor of renewables, but I also have to be realistic. I mean, wind and solar are, you know, something like, you know, less than 3% of our total energy consumption in the United States. And regardless of cost and technology breakthroughs, adoption is a big issue. And we're not going to get from 2 or 3% to 20% next year or next decade. It's going to take a long time. These things take time. And then you start talking about the efficiencies involved. And again, I'm a fan of renewables, but on a realistic basis, you know, back to net energy, you know, wind is like, I don't know, 7 to 1 in terms of energy out versus energy in, and solar's a lot less. Solar's 2 or 3. So these are much less efficient, much less dense forms of energy than fossil fuels. And for as much as I you know, I understand and appreciate that some people just really want to get off of fossil fuels as soon as possible, we have to be realistic, and we have to look at, well, what are you willing to give up? I mean, that's really what we're talking about. And I don't see a lot of people standing in line, you know, to stop driving their personal cars. I give talks all the time at universities, you know, and students in universities are, you know, very green oriented, and they always say, well, you know, couldn't we do this? And I just ask the question, okay, how many people in this audience drove to this talk in a gasoline powered car, you know, and like 99.9% of them raised their hand. And then I say, how many of you drove yourself versus shared with a friend? And, you know, almost everybody raises their hand. So I said, you know, that my case is rested. I mean, you know, until this group of very ecologically, environmentally minded people start adopting the technologies that get us away from so much wasteful use of oil, first of all, but energy overall, then what possible hope is there that everybody is gonna follow through and make these changes? So, you know, again, I'm not trying to be pessimistic, and I'm not saying that I'm in any way against renewables or, you know, natural gas powered vehicles. I think they're all part of the solution, but I just think that we got to really be honest and realistic as we move forward, because if not, we're going to make some big mistakes.
I couldn't agree more. And let me also preface by saying I'm a huge fan of renewables. I believe that in 100 years, we're going to be living 100% on renewable energy one way or the other. You know, whether we're all on farms with draft animals again, I don't know. But fossil fuels have a lifespan. 80% of the world's energy mix right now is fossil fuels, and we know that they're finite. So someday, you know, they do run out. Whether that's, we can argue about how long that's going to be. But I'm interested now in this idea of natural gas. You know, the president himself, two State of the Unions ago, came out and said we have 100 years of natural gas. I'm tracking a couple of these things, and I'd love to get your expert perspective on this. I know price is involved in this because the all-in price of getting gas, dry gas in particular, out of these shale plays is probably higher than the current price of gas. So if the price of natural gas went up, we might get more drilling. But I'm looking at things like the Barnett play is the oldest play we've got. I mean, you know, really intensive drilling by the charts I look at starts in 2007-ish, maybe 2008. And it looks to me like it peaked possibly forever in 2012 or thereabouts. Is that really the lifespan of an average shale gas basin, or is that just a function of the Barnett getting the legs kicked out from under it by low prices?
Well, I mean, all of those things are factors, Chris, but let's zoom out for a second and let's just talk about oil and gas plays and basins in general. And a shale gas or a tight oil play is no different from 30,000 feet than any other kind of oil or gas play. So you discover something, whether it's a field or a play or a new productive basin or a new productive country, and, you know, in a relatively short amount of time, you've found the best stuff. And so for a play, any play, to peak in, you know, the Barnett really got started with horizontal drilling in 2003. And so if, let's say, it peaked in 2012, you know, it's a decade. That's absolutely normal, anticipated behavior for any play in the world that's any good at all, and we won't argue about whether the Barnett's commercial or not. But, you know, one way or another, a lot of capital was spent drilling a lot of wells, okay? 18,000 wells have been drilled in that play. So, if you know, when you dedicate that amount of drilling to any play, whether it's tight oil, shale gas, you know, just about anything in the world, 10 years is about it before, you know, things peak and it produces for a long time afterwards, but at much lower rates. So we look at shale gas, and yeah, the Barnett's peaked and is declining. In fact, all of the shale gas plays except the Marcellus are in decline. So the other four are all in decline after a decade or less. And like I said, you know, that's not cause for pointing the finger at shale gas and saying you guys weren't as good as you said you were. It's normal. It's what you expect. And so the whole shale gas story, the 100 years of gas is just a, you know, it's a really silly number that comes from looking at all the gas that is technically recoverable, which means that, you know, again, we're back to the continental resources or the pioneer natural resources of, you know, drawing multilaterals. Yeah, you can do that, but would you ever do that? No, you wouldn't, because you can't make any money off of it. And so if you take every molecule of methane that exists anywhere in the United States and you say, what of that is technically recoverable if we didn't care a whit for having to make any money off of it? Well, you don't actually have 100 years. You got about 90 years, you know. And some people say, oh, well, big deal. It's about the same. And, you know, what I say is, gee, when I was in school, you know, a 90 was a B and a 100 was an A. So if 90 is as good as 100, then I guess a B average is as good as an A average, right? But, again, that's just, you know, that's really the, you know, that's the big, huge picture. And a ton of that gas is in accumulation so small that nobody'd ever bother to develop it, underneath national parks, underneath cities at 30,000 feet, or, you know, I mean, that's what's in that mix. Now, you know, they actually go through those kinds of estimates and say, well, gee, you know, what of all that could be a reserve? What of that could potentially be commercially producible? And you end up with, you know, something like 15 or 20 years. And then again, I always go back to, let's look at proven and proven undeveloped reserves as a benchmark. Because if the number you're talking about, you know, if you see got years, but your reserves suggest that you got 10 years, and that's about what we have, you got a big problem, guys. You can't say we got 100 when you're aggressively booked proven and proven undeveloped reserves, or maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years. So, you know, we actually start looking, and again, this is publicly available information. I mean, the EIA publishes reserves for shale gas, and anybody can go look at it. And, you know, this is not Art Berman's interpretation. This is what the EIA says. And so the total shale gas for the United States at our annual consumption rate of about 26 trillion cubic feet is 8 years. We got 8 years of shale gas. That's what we got.
Now, I'm gonna have to question that, because I'm looking at a chart right now that the EIA put out as part of its 2014 Energy Outlook, and they're looking at they're projecting all of the gas that we're going to get out of all the different formations, and they have shale gas going steadily getting larger and larger and larger in output from now until 2040. In fact, if I have my little numbers right, by 2040, it's producing nearly as much gas as coming out of shale gas alone as we are consuming today. It's a little over 20 trillion cubic feet. What are they plotting here then?
They're doing a production forecast. What they're doing is they're saying, all right, if you take the rate that production has grown in the shale gas plays to date, and you just continue that on into the future with a little bit of, you know, throwing in some contingencies, that's what you get. Now, there's a big controversy going on right now. Mason Inman published an article in Nature magazine in December, which is called The Fracking Fallacy. And in that article, he pointed out that the University of Texas Bureau of Economic Geology has done a comprehensive and detailed study of all the shale gas plays over the last couple of years, and their forecast is completely different from the EIA's. The University of Texas forecast says that gas production, all gas production for the United States, is going to peak in like 2022 and then decline. Okay, so Inman, you know, pointed this out, and there's a third source of all of this forecast work, which is a geologist named David Hughes, who he retired from the Canadian Geological Survey, and he's currently working with the Post-Carbon Institute. He did a similar in-depth, blood and guts kind of every well analysis of every well in all of the shale gas plays in the U.S., and his number is very similar to the Bureau of Economic Geology, the University of Texas number. So when I compare the UT, the David Hughes, and the EIA forecasts with, again, proven and proven undeveloped reserves, the UT is dead on. I mean, it couldn't be closer if they tried. Dave's number is slightly higher, but, you know, in the exact same general range, and EIA's is off the charts. So the question that I've asked publicly in writing is, do the guys at EIA that make the forecast talk to the guys that do the reserve accounting? Because again, you know, that's the first question that that any kind of realistic geologist or engineer or geophysicist asks. That okay, we've made this forecast. How is it similar or different from what the reserves we've got? Which, you know, doesn't mean that if it's different, you throw it away. But it, you know, it's a reality check. And I just don't I don't know the answer to this, Chris, but clearly, EIA's got two different silos that are looking, you know, at different things. But as I understand it, and I think I understand it pretty well, the UT study and the Dave Hughes study looked scrupulously at every single well and did reserve estimates for every single well. They did all the economics, all the geology, all the engineering, all the geophysics. EIA doesn't do that level of work, and they would be the first to admit it to you. I don't even think EIA has a geologist on staff. You know, they do sampling, you know, and scenarios, and so I'm not saying their work is inadequate. I'm just saying that the level of detail compared to these two other studies, if I had to put my money, I wouldn't put my money on the EIA. I'd put it on the other two because they've done the hard work. And they're coming up with a very, very different answer. And you know, you can think what you will about that. But what I ask people to take away is, look, whatever you believe is true, what you should take away is there's a lot more uncertainty around these, you know, fanciful projections than anybody wants to admit. And let's just say, for instance, that, you know, the UT or Dave Hughes study is anywhere close to right. Well, you know, we're getting ready to, you know, we're building LNG export terminals. We've already built pipelines to Mexico. I mean, we're going to be exporting 11, 12, 13 BCF a day between those two exports if nothing more is approved. And the U.S., you know, produces something like 70 BCF a day. So we've already committed to long-term export, you know, of something like 8 or 9% of what we're currently producing today. And here we've got two very credible third-party, unbiased, detailed sources that are saying we're not going to have enough gas for the United States alone past the early 2020s. And I'm saying, just like I said about oil, what are we thinking of here? You know, not that we should forbid people from exporting if they want to do it and if they can get the funding, but, you know, let's think carefully about our long-term needs as a country, and is this really a smart thing to do? And I say, no, it's a really dumb thing to do.
And I agree with that so much. And boy, I wish we had that rational planning. It's just a strategy, right? What's a strategy? Where are we going? How are we going to get there? You know, what's our vision? What are our resources? And it was interesting, you know, I noted that it is a fun little tempest in a teapot. I did see how the Department of Energy responded to those studies. And they got their knickers in a twist. I don't know if you saw this, but their response, they basically said, and I'm practically quoting here, that Patsek, one of the chief critics of the EIA methodology, it was a known associator with the peak oil crowd. So that it was like a ad hominem sort of an attack, you know, rather than a good solid point by point rebuttal. But we do need to get the data and have a rational discussion. How much resource do we really have? What's it going to take to get it out? What are the costs, both near and long term? And then what should we do with that? It's why I love talking with you about this, because it's just, it's not pessimism. It's not anti-Americanism. It's just reality. And I love the breadth of reality you're bringing to this conversation. So as we close up here, can the price of oil stay down here at, I'll just make a round number, at the $50 a barrel level for a year?
Probably not. You know, again, you have to sort through all the, you know, the grandstanding that goes on, and there's plenty of that from Saudi Arabia as well as the United States. Nobody's immune from that. And the bottom line, Chris, is that if you look at what are the fiscal needs of the big exporting countries, including Saudi Arabia, you know, admittedly their production costs are extremely low, you know, a couple of dollars a barrel. But they've got, I mean, it's their only source of revenue for their country. And so all the estimates I've seen say that Saudi Arabia really needs $100 a barrel to balance its fiscal budget. Some of the big producers out there, you know, Iran and Nigeria, Venezuela, it's even more. You know, it's $110, $120 a barrel. There are a few that are less. Okay, the deep water producers, they need $100 a barrel. The shale players, they need $100 a barrel. The tar sands guys, they need $100 a barrel. So, you know, from a very high level, you look at it and say, well, if everybody needs $100 a barrel, you know, what's the reality of $50 a barrel? And the reality is that it can't go on for very long. And so, you know, will oil average $50 in 2015? It could. I suspect it'll be slightly higher. I don't know. I said suspect. I'm just guessing. But the big picture is it can't stay this low and continue to have as much production as it takes to meet the world's needs.
It's absolutely crushed production, right? I mean, we're seeing all the rapid retractions right now. But it was a year ago, in February of 2014, that we saw all the major international oil companies retract their CapEx, either freezing or slightly cutting it. And that was with oil at twice the price because they couldn't both support CapEx and dividends. Obviously, a bloodbath, relatively speaking, today at these levels. So, you know, if we take the rest of the world's conventional fields being in decline at some number, call it 3%, 5%, 6%, 7%, depending on who you believe, that's 2 to 4 million barrels a day that has to be replaced on a yearly basis. We're not going to be replacing it at these levels, right?
Absolutely. Well, we're not replacing it at much higher levels of activity either. But here's the thing that I think people need to remember. Everyone's got really short memories, okay? What's happening right now is not any different, except perhaps in degree, than what happened 2 years ago. I mean, we had a big oil price drop in 2012. It went from $125 to $90. Okay, so it was going from a higher level to what we would call now a high level. But, you know, you look at the absolute value of the fall, and it's, you know, it's not as much as what we've seen here recently, but it's comparable. This happens all the time. And the point to take away is that oil prices in real dollars, you know, constant, say, 2013 dollars, were below $20 from 1920 until 1970. Why? Because we had abundant supply. We had more supply than demand, so the price always stayed low. Beginning in 1970, for a variety of reasons, we started seeing these big peaks and valleys in oil price. You know, that we'd have an oil shock and they'd go way up, and then something else had happened and they'd go way down. Well, you know, those kinds of fluctuations, that kind of volatility, is classic behavior of any commodity that's getting to be scarce. And the perception is scarce. And so the cyclicity of high low has been a fact of life in the oil business since 1970. And it isn't going to get any better because we're not making any more oil. And the other thing that I think people should think about is all the very dire predictions about the length and depth of this particular drop in oil price. We're talking about less than 1 million barrels a day of surplus production. Okay, now 1 million barrels a day is plenty of oil, but it's nothing, compared to what any one of these countries could cut. Okay, so yeah, Saudi Arabia is, I think, acting in very clear self-interest. I don't think there's any conspiracy going on here. They're just saying, look, you know, why should we take the hit and lose revenue on production so you guys over in the United States can continue to produce your brains out and make money? What's that about? No, we're not going to cut. We want you to cut. And since you won't, we're going to help. We're going to let the conditions that will force you to cut persist for a while so that you do cut. We don't want to be the only ones cutting here. It isn't fair. That's not what they're saying, but that's what I'm saying for them. It isn't fair. Why do we expect Saudi Arabia to control the price of oil for the world? I mean, where did we get that idea? I mean, they've almost never done that. So bottom line is that I don't think this particular crisis, if you want to call it that, price crisis, will be as long or as deep as many people think. But in answer to your question, yes, oil prices could average $50 for 2015. I think they'll probably average a little bit higher. But they're going to start recovering here relatively soon. I mean, probably in the next few months, because they can't stay where they are. And low prices mean people use more oil. They drive more miles. Demand gets stimulated. This is what happens every time. So I think people should look at this as not a, you know, it's not a crisis. It's nothing unique. It happens all the time. If there is a crisis, it's that we just don't have an abundance of oil left in the world, and this is what we see. Price cycling is the classic for any commodity that's in scarcity, and that's what we're seeing.
And oil being in scarcity is obviously should be a very, very major topic of concern. And I agree with you that a lot of the signs that we're seeing are actually proof of peak oil. But of course, you know, with a little burst of ingenuity or high prices, you know, we saw the shale oil story come on, and people use that as an excuse to ignore the unpleasant reality of what we're going to do when, not if, but when oil becomes in short supply. So,
and that's because nobody wants to change the way they live.
Right, and that's why 99% of the hands go up and say, I drove here by myself. It's concerned
so,
and it's scary.
So give me a reason why I don't have to change my lifestyle, and I'll take it.
Right away, without any question. I will not examine that fact too closely. Thank you.
Exactly.
Well, excellent work, Art. And thanks so much for your time today. You've been very generous. Where can people follow you more closely?
They can go in about a week or so to artberman.com. In the meantime, they can go to petroleumtruthreport.blogspot.com. That'll be redirected towards artberman.com in about a week. But again, it's petroleumtruthreport, one word, .blogspot.com. Or they can just Google Arthur Berman Geologist and they'll find it pretty darn quick.
Great. And of course, we'll provide the link at the bottom of this podcast on our site. So thank you so much for your time today. I hope to do it again. And here's to a very interesting 2015.
Definitely, Chris. Thanks a lot for the conversation. I enjoyed it.